This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Hi, I'm Richard Gershon, the host of In Legal Terms and a professor at the University of Mississippi School of Law. If you miss a live In Legal Terms episode, find our podcast, inlegalterms.mpbonline.org.
From MPB Think Radio, you're listening to Money Talks. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotter-Janderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. They're both chartered financial analysts. Ryder holds the Certificate in Investment Performance Measurement from the CFA Institute. On Money Talks, we're here to answer your personal finance questions. Between your phone calls this morning, though, we'll be talking about financially preparing for emergency situations. And to start the show each week, we always like to talk about financial news in the news. Nancy? Good morning. What are you thinking
about
this morning?
Good morning. Well, I want to talk about dynamic pricing because it's all over social media. And when at my house, my husband stops me and says, what do you think about this Wendy's plan to change the prices on their burgers? And of course, this caused a big stir when their CEO said they might be looking at dynamic pricing in 2025. They have quickly backed up on that. So Ryder and I were talking about this dynamic pricing, and at first I said, well, can you only do dynamic pricing because you're responding to supply and demand, the demand for your product with commodities? And he said, oh, no.
Well, you can't. If wherever you see a Wendy's, there's a Burger King or a Popeyes. I'm thinking about the Wendy's I sometimes go to because they started doing breakfast. There's a McDonald's across the street. There's a Popeyes around the corner. If everyone knew their burgers cost twice as much, they would just go across the street.
Because the burger would be the same. And it's just, you know, a matter of swapping one for the other.
Of course, to some extent, I say that as someone who vastly prefers Wendy's over the ones across the street. But to someone who's just like, I need a $3 burger,
any burger will do.
They can go across the street.
Well, the other issue here is I think what they're doing is responding to a tight labor market and difficulty finding enough workers. And so if you have this peak demand and you have workers that you have to have there for the entire shift, you want to spread that work over and avoid having to beef up, so to speak.
Ba-dum-bum.
Pun intended. During
Kevin,
that time.
But pun of the day.
That's right.
Yeah. That always makes me just shudder when I think about having a restaurant business because everybody gets hungry at the same time. And so they're trying to spread that out. But that is dynamic pricing, which is just adjusting your price based on the demand for the product.
And that's another good point about the labor, because if one fast food restaurant, you look and you see that line is way backed up out into the street and the other one is moving briskly.
Because it's all about fast.
Then you may just say, oh, I can't wait 15 minutes in line for a burger. I have to go to the one across the street. So that's another play into the, well, if I knew the prices, I could just go to the one across the street. But if one is fully staffed and moving efficiently, great. If the other one is not staffed as well, then maybe they need to raise the prices a little bit to slow the business down enough for the workers they have to handle that influx.
And, of course, that line these days is the drive-through line.
It's like they're like three lines deep.
Yeah.
And they've got people out there hustling you. You know, it's crazy.
But when I travel and I see that there's no one in the drive-through line, I always think, maybe that's not the place to go.
And so again, it would be the single burger costs X dollars at 1 p.m., but at 3:30, it might be
cheaper.
Right. Okay.
Because there are not as many people showing up to order a burger.
And a lot of people have pointed out that restaurants have done quote unquote dynamic pricing for a long time without calling it that. You know, a nice restaurant might have an early bird special.
Absolutely.
They may offer a fixed price menu during the week because, goodness, who's going to a nice restaurant on a Tuesday? They're still open and they still want business. So they might offer some discounts to draw people in. Happy hours, things like that, draw people in at a quote unquote off-peak time to keep your, you know, using your all the folks you're paying to be there, you know, keep them busy and keep them working and keep the money coming in.
And I think restaurants have always had a lunch menu, which is pretty much
sometimes
it's smaller portions though on that, but that's the same concept of it's cheaper because, you know, Ryder, we'll get to your thoughts in a minute, but we do have an early caller on the line. So let's say good morning to Bobby, who calls in from Indianola. You're on the air with us, Bobby. Go ahead.
Good morning. I've got a question about a friend who died in test tanks, and his house was delinquent on taxes. Somebody paid his taxes for him. And one of my questions is, does his survivors have a right to try and pay off the taxes so the house can be retained? And also about the actual ownership of the house. Did it transfer automatically to the person that paid his taxes, or is there some process where things are put on hold and the his nearest relative still has interest or access to the property and the contents in it?
Okay, so there's a lot of things going here, and one that, because you mentioned someone else paying his taxes, that reminds me of a conversation I had with someone in the county tax office about tax lien sale. So if someone had bought his taxes at the tax lien sale, they have a lien on the house, they have some level of right to the house. If they simply went and paid for him because they knew he was delinquent and they were being a nice person, then they simply paid for him because he was delinquent and they were being a nice person. They have no right. That gives them no obligation. Anyone can go pay anyone's taxes. It's the beautiful thing. We're in tax season. If you would like to pay my taxes, please make the check out to the United States Department of the Treasury, IRS. It's in Austin, Texas. But that just paying it doesn't give you a right to the house. Buying the tax lien, that's a whole different thing. And then as far as dying intestate, that means he did not have a will. And I'm guessing he also did not have a transfer on death deed on the house. So I believe it still will need to go through the probate process.
It will have to go through the probate process. And who inherits that house and anything else that he might have had will depend on state law. And here in Mississippi, that means looking at a spouse, looking at any children, and each of those will have an equal share in that. If someone does buy your house or basically pays your taxes in a tax lien sale, there is a period of time, and I don't remember exactly what that time period is, that you can come back and make good on that, pay for the taxes, any penalties and interest, and clear that out. And people who do like to participate in that game, it's really a waiting game to see if people are just not paying attention and they don't show up, and then they can take possession. So you have a period of time, a grace period, when you can clear that out.
And also, as far as, say, you die and you have not paid your taxes for a year or so, your estate, if it can afford it, or whoever is inheriting it, can pay those, because it's a debt like any other. Well, not like any other. It's a much higher priority because you owe it to the government. But your estate can pay that. It's not that, you were a day late and you died and we're just going to snap, take that away from you. The probate process is the process that allows you to get some resolution there. So it is possible that, say, whoever the state law ends up saying, okay, you're the person who inherits this, it is possible that maybe they can pull the money together. Maybe they have the money and they're able to kind of pay off those debts and own his assets free and clear in that
way. And of course, one option would be if this person has died, and first of all, you need to go visit with an attorney to start that probate process. But it could be that the sale of the house is what is used to clear out the taxes, that all of that is done at closing.
You're listening to Money Talks. Our website, moneytalks.mpbonline.org, is one way to hear past broadcasts. You can also download the MPB Public Media app for your smartphone, and you can listen to all the local MPB Think Radio programs on your schedule. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotcher-Janderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. We're here to answer your personal finance questions. Also, we're going to be talking throughout the hour about establishing an emergency fund. And we have another caller on the line. So Ryder has graciously given up his what's financially news in the news.
He's kicking and screaming over here.
It's all right. I'm going to bring it back with a vengeance next week, folks.
But as I said, Wayne is on the line from Taylor. Good morning, Wayne. You're on the air with us. So go ahead.
Good morning. I have a friend who is terminal, and I'd like to know the things that he and his spouse need to take care of before financial transfers and inheritance and all that would be as trouble-free as possible.
Oh, man. I hate to hear that. That's a tough situation for anyone to go through, and it's wonderful that you are looking out for your friend in this way. The first thing that comes to mind is being organized, just as if you were organizing even without a terminal diagnosis to something. Knowing, at least having a list of what are my accounts and where are they. It'd be super useful if there were shared passwords. Someone knew how to get in. Everything is on your phone these days. Just being able to get into your phone to receive, you know, two-factor authentication, text, email, backups, things like that. We deal with folks who have a spouse die, unfortunately, from time to time, and that's an incredibly important thing to have access to. So starting with a list of what accounts are, and also knowing who the beneficiaries are. So whether or not it is the spouse, you know, whatever their estate plan is their own plan, but making sure the beneficiaries are set up on accounts so it's easy to transfer, and then just knowing the process, knowing that when your friend dies, he or she, you know, this spouse will need to get a death certificate and approach each of these financial institutions to go through the process of claiming or disbursing those accounts, retitling accounts, things like maybe a, you know, cars and houses. You know, don't forget about those. Think about any bills that they were paying specifically. So maybe they had a credit card, maybe they were paying a health insurance bill or something. Making sure you know who to reach out there and say, hey, we need this final bill, you know, to take care of that. Or you could, you could try to play some games there, but I'm not going to encourage that on the radio. Being organized, that's the big one. And just having those tough conversations about what you want to see in the world when you're gone. So they know how to carry out those wishes.
Well, and some accounts will have beneficiaries. If you have an insurance policy, it's going to have a beneficiary, annuity, retirement accounts. Those will have beneficiaries. Make sure that whoever you named, and sometimes people name people from years ago and their wishes have changed. But you can have accounts that don't have beneficiaries, but in Mississippi you can do a TOD, transfer on death. Sometimes it's called a POD, a pass on death, so that you put beneficiaries on your bank accounts or any other accounts that would not normally have beneficiaries, which means that goes directly to those folks without going through a will. But ultimately, he or she still needs to have a will to cover anything that would be outside of that.
Okay, thank you. Can I make one suggestion?
Sure, go ahead.
You give me some great ideas, some great things. Is there any way you can maybe make a list and maybe put it on your website or something so people would have easy access to that?
That's a good idea.
All right. Yeah, we can do that. We'll put it on the description page for the podcast that you can find, well, the archive and the podcast that you can find online. So, Wayne, appreciate that. Thanks for your call this morning. This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. If you have a personal finance question, you can email money@mpbonline.org. So we're going to be talking a little bit about emergency funds while we wait for some calls to roll in. And so I think actually this week there might be a little bit of severe weather, and that's something that an emergency fund might be good for. What are some other emergency situations that might pop up that you might need some finances for? Any thoughts?
A car repair. You know, I had one last week, Kevin, where I hit something on our wonderful highways out there. I want to send my bill to the highway department, and it shredded my tire, and I had to get the car towed. So those are things that happen. That's just part of life. And so when we think about an emergency fund, it's going to cover more than emergencies, but we think about a car repair, a house repair, some unforeseen medical bill, those kinds of things that pop up. And that's just what we all deal with.
Yeah, there are two sides to your income statement, your personal income statement, and that is how much money you make and how much money you spend. And so an emergency would be you suddenly are making less money for whatever reason, or you are suddenly having to spend more money for whatever reason. And sure, natural disasters, car wrecks, those are classic ones, but it could just be you suddenly realize your car needs replacing. Your car's just not doing it anymore.
I would say, right, that that's not really an emergency. That's a short-term need that you should already be foreseeing. You should say, oh gosh, my car is starting to wear out. I know how old it is. I think I'm going to have to replace it, because we have a lot of people who come through and tell us that.
That's true.
Prepping for that. So that emergency fund and your short-term needs can be in the same place.
Right.
But, you know, it could be something that you just know is going to happen, but it's going to happen pretty soon.
I guess I was conflating emergency savings with your regular savings.
Yeah.
But they're all kind of at the end of the day, like you said, you might have it all in one account. You may just, if you know that you have an expense coming up, of course we do recommend trying to save for that specific event, specific expense. But it could be in the same place. That's true.
What is it, just me, or because to me, I like to have separate baskets, I guess you could say.
Oh, you're one of those. Yes.
That's not super unusual.
In my instance, I would like to have a separate thing that is strictly the emergency fund and another one that might be savings.
Well, and I'm going to go back to our previous caller. You are a single person. What if something happens to you and you've got all of these baskets out there? So I understand that psychological, emotional need to have those different baskets, but it makes sense to have it in one place, because you're probably going to have one place that gets the best interest rate, one place that if something happens is easier for somebody to track down.
This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. We're looking for your personal finance questions this morning. We're also talking about establishing an emergency fund. If you have a question or a comment, you can email money@mpbonline.org. So in a family situation, if there's maybe a newborn baby or a family member who becomes hospitalized and can no longer live by themselves, what sort of conversation do you think families need to have about that? Maybe pooling resources sometimes? Any thoughts on that?
Well, and sometimes that will be the case if you have parents in particular who have needs, and there need to be conversations. And first of all, the parents need to be able to open up their financial statements and share those with the family members so that everybody's on the same page as far as what is available to be used. And then there needs to be conversations about, well, what happens when all of that is gone, and how do you want that person cared for?
I think being on the same page is a big thing. And we were just talking about writing wills. And very often, especially if you have children, in your will, you might be designating a guardian. Okay. And make sure you don't have to designate the same person as guardian. But as parents, you should kind of be on board together with a lot of things. And it might make sense to make sure, okay, well, this is who we're going to pick as the primary guardian. And here's why. And here's who we're picking as secondary guardian, and here's why. You have to consider, you know, your parents are much older than your children, and they may not be able to take care of them forever. You may have siblings who can or cannot help. So making sure you kind of think about that, but also tell that person, you know, if someone's like, how about you pick the other sibling? They're more responsible with kids. Maybe that's some input you might want to take into account.
And so I guess if you're kind of figuring out how much you need to save each month in your monthly budget, you do need to kind of think about the short-term needs and the unexpected, oh my gosh,
exactly.
I ran over
yes.
something and my tire got shredded.
So. Yes. So the short-term needs could be, as we mentioned, I'm going to need to buy a new car.
Planned expenses.
Yeah.
Yes.
A down payment for a house, a vacation, my teenager's heading off to college. All of those things that are out there that you're going to need to keep those funds in a cash-like investment, not exposed to the market, you can think about all of those issues.
We've got another caller on the line, so we'll say good morning to McCartney, who calls in from Louisiana. Good morning. You're on the air with us, so go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call, and I don't know if this is an appropriate question or not, but as a small business owner, I have entered into a handshake contract with a client. I provided goods and services, and the client now refuses to pay or has only paid a portion and refuses to pay the remainder. I didn't know what the procedure was for attempting to collect that unpaid debt.
Well, it does depend on how big the debt is. You might look at small claims court. You might need just to go visit with an attorney to see what your options are. Sometimes just a letter from an attorney can spur someone to say, hey, I need to clear this out before it gets any more serious here. But a local attorney could tell you what your options are. But again, small claims court, if it's small enough.
This is a great point about documentation. And of course, you know, I'm not trying to berate anybody for having a handshake contract. This happens all the time. But you do have some documentation. Maybe you have some parts or goods that you ordered. Maybe you have some invoices that you delivered. Maybe you have some, you have some evidence and documentation of what you have done, of what you have delivered. And it's going to be really important to gather all that together. But really, ultimately, it just comes down to what are you as the two parties willing to do? It may be possible. So some writing that might be in a contract already that you would maybe it's worth pursuing is going to mediation, which is kind of it's one of the steps you would take before you would say sue somebody is you sit down with I believe mediators are all lawyers. They're just kind of trained in the conversation and the resolution skills. And they would help guide you through trying to come to an agreement there. You know, maybe there's some differences that you know, you're just not hearing. Maybe there's some issues that they're just not hearing from you. So a mediator may help. Of course, that's generally not legally binding, but gather all your documentation. And then, like Nancy said, that might be an issue for a strongly worded letter from a lawyer.
All right. Go ahead.
I'm not familiar with small claims courts. Do you have to have legal representation?
No. I think it's the idea is that it's a very simple, there's a dollar limit on what can go through a small claims court. There is a judge, and you know, think about sort of like Judge Judy, but it's not quite like that.
It's like Judge Judy, but hopefully less drama, right?
Yes. And so
I want to say it's less than, for disputes less than $2,000.
I can't quite remember. Probably is just some forms you fill out to say what the issue is, and then you're allotted a time when you can go speak.
Yeah, McCartney, I would say you're calling in from Louisiana. I would think if you did a quick internet search for a small claims court, it would give you some information about the process and the limits, how much money you could try to get for it. But
in Louisiana, their laws are so much different from ours. They're different from anybody's.
French. Yes, they're French. It's crazy. Yeah. And of course, add to the documentation list any communications you have with that person. So that might be valuable too, because even though you don't have a written and signed contract, you probably have something really close in writing that looks like an agreement. So that's what people want to look at.
All right. We appreciate your phone call. And I would say this reminds me, years ago, I had a roommate, and we didn't have any sort of formal contract or whatever, but we did make a point of having a sheet of paper that just basically said, you know, you agree to pay me this much money per month for rent.
Sounds like a contract to me, Kevin.
Okay. That is a contract.
Well, Kevin went to law school, okay?
But I guess the point then is a contract isn't some sort of fancy something that you have to go to a lawyer to get.
No, not necessarily. Nope. Unless you're dealing with real property. And you've got to have a formal contract at that time. But Verbal agreements can be contracts. Mm-hmm.
That's
and so
right.
That's what he mentioned, a handshake agreement. It can be a contract.
That is a verbal contract.
Depending on what it was and how, what kind of evidence you have of that supports that.
But again, a simple thing would be after you make the verbal contract, write something down and both people sign it.
Yes.
Yes. So the verbal contract, still a contract, but then again, you take that to a judge and one person says we had a contract and one person says we didn't. You just see where that goes. Judge Judy all the way.
Yeah.
Money Talks is MPB Think Radio's personal finance broadcast. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotter-Janderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. They're both chartered financial analysts, and Ryder holds the Certificate in Investment Performance Measurement from the CFA Institute. We're ready to take your personal finance questions. You can email money@mpbonline.org. So you have a personal finance question. We're glad to take it. In between time, while we wait for another call to roll in, we've been talking a little bit about creating an emergency fund. And I guess what I think is an important part about this whole thing is peace of mind, because I know I thought I had a leaky roof a couple of months ago. So I had someone come out. Turns out there was not a leak in the roof, but I was a little nervous about what the, you know, what the possible repair bill might be, but felt a little bit better in that I had an established an emergency fund. So if you would maybe talk a little bit about the importance of peace of mind.
Well, I think more than peace of mind, it keeps you out of what I call the credit card ditch, which is what most people do. They don't have any sort of emergency fund, short-term savings account. And then when something happens, they just pull out the credit card. And the danger there is that you then let that roll over until you have 20% interest on something like a roofie leak.
A roofie leak.
A leaky roof.
I like it.
You like it? Yeah. Okay, we're going with it.
Roofie leak. Need repair.
So that's the real problem. And I think a lot of people tend to live in arrears. You know, I'm going to put this on my credit card today and I'll worry about it tomorrow. And then that's how that ends up building up. So that's what a good emergency savings account does for you. It keeps you from falling into that credit card cycle.
All right. So here's a question then. What if you think you can pay it off, say, 2 months, 3 months? Because that's been my issue is you work so hard, you know, to build up this emergency fund. And it's almost like you don't ever want to have to use it.
Oh, but that's what it's for. And I hear the same thing all the time. Oh, no, I don't want to touch my emergency fund. But that's why you have it.
That's what it's for.
That's why you have it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think, okay, I have, say, a $10,000 expense, and I think I can put that on my credit card and pay that off in 3 months, but you also have $10,000 in savings, then I'm guessing you could build that $10,000 back in 3 months, and you would still have that credit card in case you had another $10,000 expense the next day. Like, then, yes, we fall back on that. But that cash savings would be your first place if you can't pay that before the credit card comes due.
And, of course, the other part then is if you're paying it from your emergency fund and paying yourself back, you're not also tacking on the interest that a credit card would
absolutely
have.
Mm-hmm. And for every family, they need to have some number that is we need to keep X number of dollars in our emergency savings mm-hmm. account to cover, whether it's 500, 1,000, 5,000. If I'm dealing with somebody who's a little bit older who might have some bigger issues, bigger health crisis, I'm going to push them to have more in savings.
How do you come up with that number, Nancy?
How do I come up with a number? I just pull it out of the air, Ryder. But the point is, if you have that number and something happens, the roof or the leak is roofing, then you use that money. And then you really buckle down to build that account mm-hmm. back up and get it back to your magic number.
Right. The emergency savings eases the pain of having to pay it, but it doesn't. You still have to buckle down. You still have to, you know, get that money back in there. But you don't have to do it when you're in a bad situation. One of the things I think about for how big a number you want is thinking about what an emergency looks like to you. So we've talked about a roof leak. Okay, you're probably going to file a claim on your homeowner's insurance. What's that deductible? Maybe you have great homeowner's insurance, great medical insurance, great car insurance, all of that. Your deductibles are super low, your insurance is going to take care of a lot of you in emergencies, but there's still a couple dollars to pay in deductibles. Make sure you have that saved. Does an emergency look like an accident or a medical issue where you're out of work for several months? Make sure you have your expenses covered. In particular, any debts or any real fixed costs. So if you have a mortgage, make sure that is going to be very important. You don't want to, be out of work and have your house taken from you. If you owe back taxes or you owe some other loan, make sure you have money to cover those as well as your regular expenses for several months. And so that several months expenses, deductibles on insurances, those sort of things are what you add together to come up with a number for your emergency fund.
And, we've gotten kind of lax because labor market is tight. People are working. They're earning more. They're able to move up to better paying jobs. Mm-hmm. And so they assume it's always going to be like this.
Not always
going
to be like
that. No, it's not. This is the perfect time to really build up that good savings account because we know at some point in the future.
Something's
going to
happen.
Something's going to happen. Things will get tighter. Your job may be in question and you need to be prepared.
And getting in that habit of savings also makes your budget more resilient to an emergency. So, for instance, if you're spending $1,000 a month, well, if you play around with your budget, and you're like, well, I've got an extra $100 a month now. Well, that means you need less to live on as well. So that's good. It doesn't mean you have to live on less. If you want to spend some of your money and you're financially fit in other ways, like that is A-okay. That is what it is for. But knowing that you can cut back is going to be important. And kind of thinking about bigger emergencies and other factors. If you are the sole breadwinner for a family, if you've got dependents who can or cannot work, that's going to mean maybe I need a bigger emergency fund. If your income is super steady and super assured, then fantastic. Maybe you can get away with a little bit less. I always hate telling people they can get away with less. They don't really take advantage of that one. But if your income is less stable and more dependent on, say you work on commissions, say you work in a restaurant, and you're dependent on tips, then you probably will want a larger emergency savings in proportion to what your needs are. And then, of course, kind of beyond that, you might want to look at, especially once you've got your emergency savings down pat, might want to look at life insurance if you have dependents or disability insurance if you might need to replace your own income.
This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. We're looking for your personal finance question this morning. Mike has called in, and he's up next, calling in from Waveland. Good morning, Mike. It's your turn, so go ahead, please.
Yes. What is the safest way to draw equity out of your house that is currently paid for?
Wow. Mike, how old are you?
74.
And
yes.
What is your intention for that equity? What do you need it for?
To rebuild my lift on the house.
Okay, so you're going to be putting that money back into the house. So probably doing a home equity line of credit. Now, I will tell you, as we talk to people these days in rising interest rates, typical rates on a HELOC is around 8% or more.
Mm-hmm.
Just expect that. They tend to be variable, which means they will adjust. If rates go up, they may go higher. We're hoping that rates will go down and they will adjust down. But a HELOC allows you to draw as you need the money for that project. And so to be able to declare that interest on your income taxes, it has to be a loan that is used for the house.
Yeah. And another option we often talk about is a cash out refinance. But, hearing that you're 74, it sounds like a fixed income. It might be a little harder to qualify for one of those. I think a HELOC is probably going to be an easier route, if a little bit more expensive. But like Nancy said, the flexibility of you don't owe it all from day one. You can get that HELOC. You can start work 3-6 months later. You can make that final payment way down the line and just get back to it as you can. So that flexibility is going to be great for a project like that, it sounds like.
Visit with your local banker. When you sign up for a HELOC, they are contracts, again. Read the fine print because there will be some expectation.
They're not going to do it just a handshake over this.
No,
just,
we're not.
Just deliver a sack of 20s over to his house.
But typically, you have to pay some percentage of the principal that is due plus the interest on whatever you've taken out each month. But it is a nominal or a small amount, and at some point, you may be looking at larger payments depending on what your needs are.
Okay. All right. Well, I still work. I love working, so I'm still working, and I'm drawing Social Security. But I just needed that little extra bit to get me through.
Well, it sounds like a HELOC would do it for you, and you've got the income to cover any of those payments and be able to stretch out that project over a period of years.
All right. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Good luck.
We're glad you found our show, Money Talks. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotter-Janderson, president of New Perspectives and Ryder Taft portfolio manager at New Perspectives. We've got a caller on the line, but before we get to that, one quick follow-up from our previous call. We talked about the HELOC, the home equity line of credit, and I'm wondering the advantage of the line of credit versus a straight home equity loan.
Well, a home equity loan, for instance, if you think this is going to be a $20,000 project, a home equity loan, they're going to hand you that $20,000 up front, which means that's when the clock starts, that's when your debt starts, that's when the interest on the full amount starts, and there will tend to be these fixed payments over a fixed period of time. That's the way it tends to work.
Also, the cost of a home equity loan, you know, a cash out refinance mortgage, it's going to have kind of normal mortgage fees, which could be $1,000 or a couple thousand dollars, whereas a home equity line of credit, being a much more, the bank makes this product, the bank is just, they're setting it up for you. They can be really cheap or potentially free to set up. So
yeah, and with a HELOC, that $20,000 project, they may say, we'll give you up to $20,000. Mm-hmm. And you start, and as Ryder mentioned before, now I'm going to go to the home store. I've got to buy lumber, and so I have $1,000 up front. So you take, you write your check, or you mm-hmm. use your card for that $1,000, and you work your way up to the full amount. So you have more control over that. The interest yeah. is not as much on the full amount.
And I guess you're right. So if something had happened in the middle of your project to make you want to delay it, with a HELOC, it's okay because you haven't. But with
Correct.
The loan, you've got it, and you're
yes,
you're on the,
exactly. You got to
right,
get it done.
Yeah, you got to get that money back. Now, a mortgage or a cash out refinance, you know, it's very good from a budgeting standpoint because you know exactly how much you're going to owe. But of course, yes, you have a declining amount that you actually have access to, and goodness knows if it takes forever to get a contractor, and then all of a sudden you don't have enough, and oh, on top of that, it was a $2,000 fee for what's a $20,000 project. That's extraordinarily expensive, even if the interest rate was a couple of points less.
And a cash out refinance, which writers mentioned a few times, they tend to not want to do that unless you have a larger amount, typically yeah. 50 to 100,000. So if you have like a bigger, like I'm putting an addition on my house, total redo, that's when you might look at something like that because they want a larger amount. And of course, you deal with all those costs.
We've got another phone call to get to. Off to Rankin County we go. Chris is on the line. Good morning, Chris. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, Nancy and Ryder.
Good morning.
What is your deal on once you're in the retirement phase and you've got a couple of buckets of money, but maybe you don't have a third bucket and you've got these insurance people trying to sell you their annuity product? Instead of that, if you have Roth as part of one of those two buckets, investing in real estate, maybe to rent out long term or to do short term rentals or whatever, and then using it recreationally the other part of the time versus keeping it all in a investment status like that.
Sure. Yeah. So there's a couple of different ways to think about buckets, and you kind of alluded to a couple of different styles of bucket. So one you mentioned Roth, and presumably a Roth IRA versus a deferred tax IRA versus just what we call a regular taxable account, an individual account, a joint account, an account that doesn't really have special rules around its taxes. Those are three buckets of taxability, I would say. A Roth bucket is fantastic to have because that is tax-free when you withdraw it, again, you know, according to the rules. But generally speaking, when you're over 60, you're kind of good to go in there, no penalties. There's a lot of ways to get money out of a Roth IRA with no penalty and, of course, no taxes there. IRAs, 401k, deferred style accounts, that's for a lot of people, that's where a large amount of your savings are, especially if you had a kind of a good paying professional job that offered that sort of benefit and you were a good saver throughout your career. You've probably grown a pretty good 401k, IRA, something like that. And that is still going to be an important part of your financial plan. For a lot of people, that's, I like to think of that as like a baseline income, but every dollar coming out of there is taxable. So that's why you want to keep it to that baseline income, and you don't want to use it for the extraordinary large expenses that you might have a Roth or a taxable account for. Taxable account, just extra savings, more savings, tons of flexibility there. So that's one bucket style and why it's important to have kind of a diverse range of tax buckets there. You mentioned insurance products like annuities. Those are both a product, like a type of investment with a type of returns, but they are also a tax designation. They have tax treatments themselves, typically less favorable on the tax side than just investing in an individual account, just having an account with some investments to let it go, just because growth in an annuity, if it's a non-qualified annuity, is typically taxed as income. Of course, growth in an IRA annuity is taxed as income. So less favorable on the tax side. Also, generally speaking, they can address some very specific needs, but those needs often don't align, I find, with what folks' actual goals are. So you know, a lot of them will say, oh, we have this stock market-like return, but there is a floor. You can't lose money, but then there's an extraordinary cost you have to pay for that guarantee. Well, for people who need to be exposed to a stock market-like return, typically we are looking, can they take a stock market-like risk in return for that? So again, kind of misalignment with goals there a lot of times. Real estate, a lot of people do have real estate in their portfolio. Your primary home is real estate. Many people do have rentals. There's some tax treatment there, of course. A lot of opportunity for tax deductions and, you know, fun games to play with your taxes there. The question kind of always is, with real estate, do you want to be a landlord? Is that something you want to do? I speak with folks all the time, and some of them say, yes, I love the aspect of it. I love this project. I love this thing. I speak with people who are like, nope, I am getting out of the real estate game. I am tired of it. It is just not all it's cracked up to be. It is a lot of work, and I haven't actually made any money off of it. So there's, you see all aspects of that, but you have to keep in mind real estate is – maybe not with one property, but multiple properties. It's a job. And if you want to take that on, that's fantastic. And it can be very lucrative and it can be very rewarding. But it's just, it's not a lot of people need to have that sort of thing. That's got a whole lot of other aspects to talk about too.
All right, Chris, thanks for your call. We've got to hold it there because we are out of time. Money Talks is a production of MPB Think Radio, funded in part by generous financial support from listeners. To hear today's show or a previous show, you can visit moneytalks.mpbonline.org or listen to the podcast by searching for Money Talks. So for Dr. Nancy Lotcher-Janderson and Ryder Taff, I'm Kevin Farrell, asking you to join us every Tuesday at 9 for Money Talks. It's heard only on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.